I meant to say Our Lady, Seat of Wisdom. On this final talk, we will discuss the duties of a man as a husband and a father. Now, you might say, well, what if I'm not married? This will apply to you as well, even if you don't have or are called to that vocation, because the virtues that we will discuss apply to everyone. Not only that, every man in a certain way, in one way or another, is called to those vocations, as we will see. Let's talk about the vocation. I'm not sure if this is a word, pardon me if it's not, husbandry. How can it be said that a priest has a vocation to be a husband? Or the same could be said of a single man. We can come to understand this vocation as this: to be a husband ultimately means to be fruitful. Not only that, it means to commit for the rest of your life to watch over, cherish, and protect that which has become yours. Every man, think about it, it's true, every man becomes married to something or someone. I was recently being told of a conversation between Catholic men where someone posed this question. They asked, what makes someone a true man as opposed to a boy? And one of them said, well, you know, if you want to be a true man, you have to go out there, try really hard at your job, make sure that you don't give up, don't be mediocre, all these things. And as I was hearing this conversation, the same question was in my head: what makes someone a man and not a boy? It took me just a few seconds so that before the answer came to my head. The difference between a man and a boy, what really makes someone a man, is when they have taken upon themselves a responsibility. When they become, in other words, married to something or someone, a family, a parish, a diocese, a mission, a vocation. You might be a soldier, you marry to your country. You might be an entrepreneur and you marry your company. You might be a priest and you marry your parish and God. Or you might be a husband and you're married to your wife and your children. And yes, notice that you're married to the whole of it, wife and children, not just your wife. But in the end, my dear friends, every man, every true man, will be a husband to something, a man that belongs to someone else. He might be single, but still he belongs to his neighbor, to the church, to the country. He has given his life for something. Here is a key point. A man that lives for himself is a man that hasn't matured. He's a boy. He's not complete. He's not finished. He's not yet a man. To give you a few ideas of how far off we are in today's society, this is a true story. I was living somewhere, won't say where, and there was a particular guy, 30-something, 35, 36, I don't know. And every time that I would come home, and I was a priest already, and this guy's playing video games. And he would always complain to me, wow, you guys don't help us to get married, and you don't help us to get into a relationship. And I hope he doesn't watch this video, but if he does, well, there you go, you better be married now. And he would always complain with me. He's like, why don't you guys do stuff to get people married and all that stuff? And then finally one day I arrived and I'm like, pardon the language. I said, dude, you're playing video games every night over here. Stop harassing me and get out there and date. If you want the ugliest woman in town, I don't care. Anything is going to be better than you playing video games here. At least learn something from the dating process. But that was the case. 30-something years old, every single night playing a video game. And this is not an isolated case. I think all new generations below mine can attest to that. It's a very common thing. I hear it all the time. We got married and my husband was playing video games for the first 2 years, 3 years. Doesn't make sense. On the other side, we read of men like, for example, James Sobieski. James Sobieski was the son of John Sobieski. At the age of 16 years old, he was accompanying his father in the largest cavalry charge in history. That was the Battle of Vienna. The Winged Hussars, the Knights of Poland, charged in a cavalry charge against 300,000 Turks. A charge that saved the world. 16 years old, and he was there. At 14 years old, José Sánchez del Río, he was a boy from Mexico, he left his house to join the Catholic army that was resisting the persecution of Catholics in Mexico by the communist government. José worked as an aide, as a messenger. Now, at one point, his unit was not captured, it was surrounded, it was ambushed. And during the ambush and the shootout, the commander's horse was shot. This is in the movie if you've seen it, but it's just different people, but José was there. José Sánchez rides his horse to the commander, and he gets off his horse and he tells the commander, hop in, and the commander says, no, 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 and the boy says, you are the commander, I'm just an aide, get up on the horse. So the commander finally got on the horse. José, you know, I don't know what you call that when you hit the horse in the back so that it runs. And as the whole of the company of men are fleeing, they're getting away from the Federals, José, 14 years old, stayed back, shooting, covering their retreat. They say that when the soldiers came, he just threw the rifle at them when he had no more ammo. He was a messenger. That means that he knew all the locations of the different camps and sites. So the communist captain took him into a basement and tortured the boy in many ways, trying to get out information from him. As you've seen probably already, they peeled and sliced off the soles of his feet, forcing him to walk on his living flesh to the place where he died, his mother watching. And when they asked him if he would renounce Christ, he shouted out, Viva Cristo Rey, long live Christ the King, and thus he passed. Was this a child? Of course not. This was a man, and the difference was that he had responsibilities. He was married to his cause. Let's speak then, my dear friends, of the duties of a husband. Not all of them, at least, but some. The first thing that I will mention is this. You, as the head and the husband, have the duty to strive for your own perfection. And I will give you 3 points in which you must do so. Professionally, morally, like natural virtues, and then spiritually. What do I mean professionally? God said to Adam, grow and multiply. Of course, this can be taken as a commandment to mankind, but it is also a commandment to man. As if God was saying, I've created you, become better, grow in every sense, and multiply, meaning bear fruit. Even the Greeks, even the pagans understood this. Socrates said, it is a shame for a man to grow old without seeing the beauty and strength of which he is capable. Now you might say, Father, I think you're getting too materialistic. You're in the pulpit. You're supposed to be preaching of spiritual things. Isn't this too materialistic? I will answer no. Because first of all, when you as a man work, in whatever it is you do, you must first and foremost work to please God. If you're in the shop, work to please God. If you're in the farm, work to please God. If you're in an office working for, the worst case scenario, Microsoft or Adobe or whatever, work to please God. And what happens? If you are working to please God, not for money, not for pride, not to gain material success, lo and behold, how should you work? As perfectly as you can, as responsibly as you can, as efficiently as you can. That doesn't mean you can't change jobs or you can't make changes, but it means that whenever your intention is supernatural, for God, for that reason, you will strive for perfection. Be the best you can at your job. Learn as many different traits and abilities as are available to you, whether you are there in your field or not. Open all the doors you can for you. In every opportunity, seek constantly, how can you become better? How can you learn more? How can you be more efficient? Learn from everything and everyone. In other words, don't be idle ever. If you lack some talents, make up with the ones you have. Find others. Our Lord said, "My Father worketh always, even now, and I work also." We must do the same in a constant pursuit of professional growth. Pardon me if I use as an example my father. May he rest in peace. He gave me good examples in many things, and this was one of them. One of the things that from childhood I remember, there was this room, his office, I guess you would say. And in this office, there was a whole wall covered with diplomas. There must have been 30 of them. A course on oil manufacturing, a course on architectural design, a course on this, a course on that, a course on gardening, a course on whatever. And as a child, I never noticed. As a teenager, I started noticing more. And I remember when I started working, my dad one time pulled me aside and he said these things. He said, "Take every class that you can, every course that you can. If you're not interested, doesn't matter. If it seems like you won't use it, doesn't matter. Everything that you can learn will be an asset for you. And even if you don't use it, you will understand other people better." It is so true. I said then professionally, the second way in which you must grow is morally. I mean to say by that, with natural virtues. So we have three levels. One is the purely natural, the professional. Then there is the moral that touches virtue. And then we'll have the spiritual side. As a man, you are bound to grow morally in two ways, by cultivating your intellect and your will. Cultivate your intellect by learning constantly, by reading, by learning stories, learning crafts, arts, being inspired by the examples of others. How pitiful, how poor a man that sits on the TV, that scrolls on the phone during his times of leisure, instead of cultivating his mind, instead of learning some new science, for learning history from other people, learning about his faith. A man reading at night, studying some topic, fashioning something new, perfecting himself in some art, that's what we should see, not an idiot wasting his time watching slop. Cultivate your intellect. You're also bound to cultivate your will. This means exercise, challenge, difficulty. It might come in the form of bodily training. It might come in the form of some project at home, some moderate risk undertaken, some great idea that you fight to bring to fruition. But the way in which you spend your leisure time should be in such a way that at the end of it, you find yourself stronger, more resilient, more capable. Beating the dead horse, as I love to do, how shameful to find men drinking beer, playing video games again as adults, binge-watching something, when there are so many activities, so many things they could do, even recreational, that could build them up and elevate their minds. I'm going to make a quick parenthesis here. I experienced this on my own because I grew up in a way that I wasn't challenged. I went to school, everything was easy. Video games, computers, playing with my friends, no challenges whatsoever. There was no moment where I had a goal and I had to finish it other than school. And when I joined the monastery, and in the monastery they started saying, you have to do this job. And sometimes you're crying wanting to do the job and you can't figure it out. For a child, grab a child that has never done anything like that, that has never used a drill, and put him to build a shed. I assure you he will cry at some point if he's never used tools, because you are totally blind. You don't know how to do it. But that's exactly what we need as men. If you have children or you know people that have children, from a very young age, challenge them. Give them something that's going to make it difficult and that they will have to finish. And that builds character. It builds your will. It builds your intellect. To give another example of this, going back to my father, when he must have been 60, 64 years old. He had retired long ago from architecture, but he was teaching. He always loved teaching. And he was elderly, you know, well, no offense to you guys, but at 60-something, you know, people don't want you to work a lot. And so they kicked him out of the career of architecture. They didn't want him there anymore. And kind of as a way to be nice with him, thinking he was going to say no, they said to him, you know, we offer you to be head of physical therapy. We're opening a new career of physical therapy. If you want, you can be head. My dad was an architect. No idea of physical therapy whatsoever. And he says, okay. The principal says, well, you offered. Yeah, sure, I'll take it. I'll need to learn now, but sure, I'll take it. And he worked in the career of physical therapy for, I think it was like 5-6 years. And they were surprised because he actually made good changes in the career. It became the leading. I'm not praising my father. I'm just saying, you know, that's something that men could do. He took the challenge. He learned. He had no idea. The first time he met with the teachers of the faculty, he straight up said to them, I have no idea of anything of this. I'm not related to the field at all. You guys are the experts. I'm just going to work with you to make the best career we can. And they made it to the point where that faculty was the first, I think, in the state, the leading one. So that's, my dear friends, as a man, that's what we should do, also grow morally. So we've said professionally and morally. Now the last and the most important, spiritually. This is the most important to emphasize because it is the least popular, of course. Men, for some reason, are much more prone to fall into a complacent comfort, never to try to become perfect in heart and soul. It's kind of outrageous that if I ask you, any of you, should the priest be perfect? Of course. Should the sisters be perfect? Well, yeah, that's their vocation. They're vowing to be perfect. Should you be perfect? Oh, Father, you know, I'm a sinner. But our Lord said again, be ye therefore perfect, as also your heavenly Father is perfect. Yes, you are not a priest. Yes, you are not a religious. But if you mean to call God in heaven Father, you also must strive for perfection spiritually. And I will mention to you here just 2 points. Okay, I need to say this before I continue. This talk was written before. I say that because I've been talking to some of you in counseling. You might be tempted to think Father's talking about me. That's not the case. This was written before. This doesn't apply to anyone in particular. It was written before. The first point then is, I'm just going to shoot to kill. This applies to some. It might apply to some. Stop being a hypocrite. Stop pretending. Stop being dishonest. Again, this might or not apply to you, but I'm addressing men and I'm going to tell it how it is. It is not a few times that the priest encounters a man who is terrible with his wife, who is terrible with his children, who is violent, cruel, seriously neglectful of his duties. And yet when the priest comes and asks, outside of confession, of course, when he speaks and says, what have you done? What is there wrong? How are you failing? Nothing. And they know it. After the priest leaves, he will scream to his wife. He will be mean to his children. He will neglect. He will say no to praying the rosary, whatever it is. But they're terrified of showing their true colors to the priest. I'm not saying, very important, I'm not saying you should tell your sins to your wife or to your children or to your friends. I'm saying you should have an authority, the priest in this case. But a man that is a hypocrite in this way, that shows one face to the priest and then the face of an ogre to his wife, these are souls, and I'm not exaggerating, these are souls bound to hell if they don't repent. Cut it out. Own your actions. Admit it. If you're weak, if you're violent, if you have done terrible, horrible things, when the priest comes to call it upon you, which is rare, that is a blessing. If the priest actually calls you up on it, it's a blessing. It's rare that that happens. If it happens, admit it. Say it. Be a man. That is the beginning of virtue. You won't be able to correct what you cannot acknowledge. You cannot eliminate what you don't despise. Be sincere then and recognize your faults, especially half a superior. Half a superior. And I'll tell you even more. If the priest doesn't go to correct you, if the priest, which is, we don't have a lot of time, if the priest doesn't go to your home and tells you you're doing this and this wrong, you call the priest and tell him, Father, come home. Wife, what am I doing wrong? Father, tell me what I'm doing wrong. I'll try to correct it. I'll try to mend my life. Great. Do that. I assure you success. Do that. I assure you the solving of every problem in your family. It's not going to happen overnight. But if you have that attitude, anything can be solved, at least on your part. The second point, when it comes to spiritual perfection, aspire to holiness. My friends, stop believing that being a good Catholic is enough, or rather, let me say it better, there is no such thing as a good Catholic that does not aspire to perfection. There is no such thing as a good Catholic that does not aspire to perfection. You know that when they canonize someone, what they're searching for is heroic virtue. And one has to laugh with the Novus Ordo. I don't know if you're familiar. They recently canonized this guy, Carlo Acutis. Probably a very good guy. Nothing against him. Maybe he's in heaven. I hope he is. But this was a young man that basically had devotion to the Holy Eucharist and liked to play video games and had experience with computers. Far from what the church calls heroic virtue. Heroic virtue is sanctity. You, men, aspire to have the heroic practice of Christian virtue. I don't need to describe it. You see it. You know what it would look like. Have heroic patience in your household. Have heroic humility with your fellow parishioners, with your family, at work. aspire to heroic mortification of your tastes, of your desires. Give heroic effort in prayer. Have heroic courage to uphold morality and religion. You see what I mean? These things are not optional. These are things that you ought to do as a man. It is something you will be judged upon. How could it not be? You say the priests, they should be perfect. They should be virtuous. You are a priest. You have a priestly duty at home. You also must strive to give a good example, to lead your family by and through your own perfection. What would you think of the priest if you see him scrolling 3 hours at the night? You would think he's a bad priest. What would you say of the priest if you saw him watch the Super Bowl and then TV for 6 hours? You would say he's a bad priest. What would you think of the priest if the children are here horsing around and he's watching TV or playing video games or going to play poker with his friends? You would say he's a bad priest. You are a bad father. If your children are playing around alone and you don't play with them and you don't discipline, you are a bad father. If you're watching TV for 2-3 hours and your children, you don't know if they did their homework, if they said their prayers, if they pick up the room, you are a bad father. You are a priest. Whatever you would judge poorly in the priest, judge it on yourself. You are a priest at home. I'm not saying here that we should judge each other. Many of the men who resisted Vatican II, the changes in Vatican II, were men who functioned as priests in their homes. They're going up again to my family because these are people that I know from up close. And if I say someone that is not my family is on video, and then they could see it on YouTube and get offended with me. My grandpa, when the changes came, he was a farmer. He was a very instructed man. When the changes came, he went and told the priest, like, this is wrong. You should not be saying mass facing me. I'm not God. You should face towards the altar. And the priest was like, well, these are the changes, things like that. So my grandpa, actually, if I remember correctly, he stopped going to the new mass. He was dying. And when he was dying, the priest came and said to him, I'll have mass for you, Roberto. I'll give you communion. And my grandpa said, okay. And the priest started setting up for the Novus Ordo. And he said, get out. Get out. Father, with all due respect, I love you, but you're not going to have that new mass for me. I'd rather die without the sacraments. And the priest got really angry and said, well, you're on your own. And he left. And then a couple weeks later, here comes the priest back. Not saying anything, just walked into the room. He started setting up for the Latin Mass, and he said the Latin Mass for my grandpa. Because, I say that with all due respect, but maybe, my grandpa was more of a priest than that priest. He was stronger in his faith than that Novus Ordo priest, now Novus Ordo. Same thing happened with the father of Bishop Pivarunas. I'm sure you know that story. Raise your hands if you've heard that story before. Bishop Pivarunas, he started going to Mass. Well, they were going to Mass with his family, with his father. And one day the priest started preaching probably about the Novus Ordo and the new religions and how every religion was good and all that stuff. And in the middle of the pew, Mr. Pivarunas, and all the family gets up, large family too, and they just walk out of the parish in front of everyone. And the priest went and told them, hey, what's this that you did? That's wrong. That was very offensive. I don't want you to come back to the church if you're going to behave like that. And Mr. Pivaruna said, oh, you don't need to worry. We're not going back to the church because of what you're preaching. He kept the faith. He found a good place, a good traditional place, and eventually his son became a bishop. Again, a man that perhaps was more of a priest than the one that was on the altar. My dear friends, then three things in which you must strive for your perfection, professionally, morally, and spiritually. Now, the next point. This is something I haven't touched before because it doesn't concern every one of you, perhaps, but many of you are married, and this year I wanted to touch upon this because it's something that needs to complete the retreat. A good husband will also love his wife. If you're not married, try to use that for the case that you get married. If you don't plan to get married, try to see the virtues, the spirit behind what I'm about to say. It would seem odd, my dear friends, that I need to speak to men about how to love their wives. But truth be told, it is something we can forget, something we absolutely ignore. And let's be really honest, sometimes it can be difficult. How could it not be? Your wife is not an angel, neither are you. She's a human being with faults, you are another. Of course, at times it can be difficult. How should we understand this? When you're married, when you go through the marriage instructions, the gospel, the church teaches you what you ought to be to your wife. How should you be? What's the picture of what you should be? You should be to your wife what Christ is to the church. I will mention a few things. The first one is this. Love, my dear friends, love is voluntary. It is an act of the will. It's something you decide to do. If it wasn't voluntary, it couldn't be a commandment. But the fact that our Lord can say, this is a commandment that you will love your neighbor, your wife, means that it is absolutely voluntary. It's up to you. And so, to be very blunt, if you have come to a point in your marriage when you no longer feel tenderness to your wife, when she is no longer someone you long to be with or talk to or hang out with, where you don't feel love, let's say it, I have news for you. You vowed to love your wife. You took an oath, in other words, to love her in front of God. Make yourself love her and act accordingly. If you don't feel tenderness, then meditate on it and convince yourself of it and feel it willingly. If you don't long for her presence, find supernatural reasons to do so, convince yourself of it and feel it willingly. If you don't find her attractive or interesting or even pleasant, supernaturalize it and out of charity, convince yourself of it and do it willingly. You ought to be Christ for your wife. How did Christ love? Do you think, we can't see the picture right now, but do you think he had reasons to love us? Do you think he felt like loving us? I can't love my wife, you tell me. She's disrespectful. She's disobedient. She's proud. She's talkative. No offense to the wives. Well, be like Christ. Do you think he felt like loving the soldiers that spit upon him, that slapped him? Do you think he had good feelings towards them? No, he didn't. But he willed to love them. And so you must. You promised it. You vowed it before God. Every day, every moment, at every turn, no matter how difficult, you ought to love your wife by sheer will, if nothing else, and show it. And this you do because you swore an oath. This you do out of love for God. Now, what does that love look like? My dear friends, when a person loves, he forgets entirely about his rights, his desires, and he focuses on the needs of the loved one. How do I love my wife, Father? I'll give you three things, 3 points, very quickly. And I promise no wife paid me for this. I should actually ask for that. The first thing is this. Treat your wife with absolute respect. Your wife is a sacred being. She's a mother. She's someone worthy of all respect and consideration. Never allow yourself to treat her with contempt or insult. Even if you need to correct her, always do so civilly, politely, respectfully. I'll give you the cue that I always give. Whenever a woman asks me, "How, Father, what's the proper way to be respectful to my husband?" I tell them, think that you're talking to a priest. In the same way that you would correct a priest, in the same way that you would bring a problem to a priest, in that same way, bring it to your husband. Same tone, same words, same respect. I tell you the same. You wonder, how would that even look like, treating my wife like that? Well, imagine that you're talking to a sister. That's weird, you might say, but no, I mean, with that same respect, with that same deference, you would never go to a sister and be sarcastic. You would never go to a sister and bring faults from the past. You would always treat her with religious respect. Treat your wife with religious respect. All things considered, of course. The second point that I give you, you might think, well, I don't know if Father should be saying this from the pulpit, but it is important, and it is holy too. Remember that a woman has needs that men don't have and often don't understand, and I mean emotional needs. I always tell married men, think of your wife. I'm not phrasing it right, but bear with me. I say, it's just like with a plant. If you have a plant, you have to water it constantly. Every day, you have to bring water, a little bit of water, every day or every week, however long it might be. Your wife also needs to be supplied for those needs, emotional needs. She needs to hear that you love her. She needs to hear that she's beautiful. She needs to hear that she's doing a great job. And knowing that you truly believe it. Some of you might be saying, Father, that's a feminist talk. Father, what about how our wives should be? Why don't you tell our wives how they should be? Stop whining. Do your job. I'm not here to speak to your wife. I'm here to speak to you. You might say to me, Father, why must I put myself through the chore of pandering to her emotions? You knew you were marrying a woman, didn't you? You knew she was emotional, didn't you? Think of this. This is a good point. When you married, you agreed to take care of her needs. You immediately knew, I have to feed her, I have to clothe her, I have to give her a place to live. I have to take care of her needs. Are we so foolish that we think we are supposed to take care of her material needs, but not her mental, her emotional, her spiritual needs? That doesn't make any sense. In the same way, with the same duty that you have to feed her, clothe her, and give her a place to live, you have a duty to tender to her emotions, her mental health, and her spiritual health. And I hate to use these words. I know that they're cliched by now, but you know what I mean. So that's the second point, to take care of her needs. And the third point, to love your wife. We're almost done, I promise. We have promise. The third point when it comes to loving your wife is this. Your wife needs to be able to respect you and to feel safe with you and around you. Notice that I didn't say your wife needs to respect you. I said she needs to be able to do so. In other words, men, You need to give your wife reasons to admire you, to respect you, to feel safe under your care. Especially nowadays, men often make the mistake of allowing themselves to be stupid around their wives, to be foolish about around their wives, to lose their respect, to appear doubtful, fearful, hesitant, sad, broken. And modern society would say, open up, you know, cry before your wife and all this stuff and show your sensitivity. That is not true. It's not true. You know it. Those of you who are older and who have been married, you know it. It's quite otherwise. You must act in such a way that your wife looks up to you, that you command her respect, that you earn it. Think of it this way. And you might, some of you might relate, I don't know. If you have a wife that purposefully tries to look ugly, that never takes care of herself or her appearance, every time that you see her, she just looks sloppy and purposefully sloppy, you lose interest and you would feel defrauded. A woman that looks at her husband and finds him weak, stupid, immature, less than her in virtue, also feels defrauded. She needs you to be a hero. Be one. To give you a couple stories. Sorry, I'm going to go again with my dad. That's I didn't have a lot of time for research, so this is the easy go-to. About the part of not hesitant, showing no hesitancy and no fear. One time we were in the beach, and we had a tropical storm. Close to hurricane, not quite a hurricane. So we weathered it out during the night. It was horrible. You could hear the windows breaking. The windows actually broke in the hotel. It was just, a nightmare. And then the next morning, my dad grabbed everyone and he said, okay, we need to get out of here right now because this is going to get flooded. It's going to get horrible. We're going to get stuck. So we need to leave right now. And we all remember this because it was really funny. For us, children was funny. For my mother, probably not. We are traveling out, and there is a river that goes out into the ocean, and there is a bridge that goes across the river, and the whole thing is flooded. It's like 1 foot above the bridge that the water is flowing really fast. And my dad came. I'm not saying do this at home, but take the example that I'm giving. My dad came, and my mom started panicking, and it's like, we're gonna fall, the river is gonna fall, we're gonna drown and whatever. And my dad is just like, we're gonna go because if we stay here, there's not gonna be any food, whatever, we're just gonna go. The kids, I'm super excited in the back looking at this. This is really cool for me. I didn't know what we were doing. And my dad just went steady, the only truck that made it through. And he prayed probably all throughout. Right after we made it through the bridge, like a half a day later, we hear that the bridge collapsed and everybody was trapped on the other side. So now that I think about it, I get scared and I'm glad I wasn't aware of what was going on. But that, you know, that's the kind of stuff, the no hesitancy, the resolution, the conviction. I never, ever, I can't remember it. I never saw my dad cry in front of my mother. I'm sure he did. I never saw it. I remember when his mother died, I never saw him cry in front of my mother. Not once. And I'm not saying you should do that, but you get again my point. To be respectable for your wife. One time my father grabbed me also and he told me, if you need to cry, cry. Go sit down somewhere, cry for 15 minutes. And that's what I do. He told me, that's what I do. There's been a couple times where I was very troubled. And I went to my office, locked the door, and I said, okay, I'm going to cry for 15 minutes, and I'm just going to break apart for 15 minutes. And he would cry his eyes out for 15 minutes, and then he's like, okay, time's up. Smile, and he goes out like nothing happened. And as I told you, I never saw him cry in front of my mother. Now, we must finish the talk. I don't want to go too long. There's a little bit more. We've mentioned then that as a man, you must seek your own perfection. We've mentioned that you ought to love your wife, and we discovered how. The last part of the talk is this. A good husband, and this applies to all of us, a good husband seeks the welfare in all respects, at all times, at all costs of his family. I said at the beginning that every man is a husband to someone or something. Every true man becomes at one point married to some responsibility, to some duty. And in the proper destiny of manhood, every man at one point or another becomes responsible for other human beings, for other souls. As a priest, again, you might be responsible for your parish, as a father of your family. As a businessman, of your employees. Father, I'm going to be a hermit. As a hermit, you are responsible of the souls of sinners to whom it was entrusted you to pray, for whom it was entrusted you to pray. And if you are entirely on your own, as some of you might be, and none of this applies to you, then go and find someone to help and become responsible for them. But then this leads us to this point. A good husband looks for the welfare of his family. The words are this, beyond his own. He looks for the welfare of a family, of the people entrusted to him, beyond his own. I'll give you three scenarios, and with this we finish now. A man might be weak, slow, phlegmatic, the kind of guy that never seeks conflict, the kind of guy that doesn't like to argue, and where, well, the wife kind of ends up taking over. Or if not, she ends up disappointed at the lack of progress that she sees in you. This kind of man, you're not in a hurry for new job opportunities, your child is misbehaving, you don't say anything, the family steps over the boundaries, your friends do, and you're quiet about it, and you don't defend your wife or yourself, what do I say to you? Seek the welfare of your family beyond your own. For you, what does that mean? Stop your comfort. Stop the timidity. It's going to cost you to die almost. You'll be shaking when you confront people. Your voice will break. You might even cry at night. Who knows? This happens. Do it. Do violence to yourself. Forget your comfort. Being okay with people, your peace, and go and do what your family requires you to do. Do violence to yourself, push yourself at long last, seek the welfare of your family beyond your own. The other extreme, you might have a man that is a violent man, an angry man, a choleric. His wife is afraid of him, his children are afraid of him. After a while, no one wants to be around him. He will call people names. He will be great at work, very popular, with family, friends, with the potlucks. He controls everything. No mistakes allowed in the family. Transgression of the children, of the wife. He goes ballistic on the child, on the wife, or whoever. If you are this man, what do I tell you? Seek the welfare of your family beyond your own. What does that mean for you? That you will have to live your life in the blessed torture of mortification. Let things not be as you want them to be. Set rules, sure enough. Sure enough, correct in morality. But all your tastes, deny them. All your pet peeves, deny them. All your frustrations, swallow them. And not only to the point that you don't tell them to your wife or your children, but even to the point of not thinking of them. Don't stop, stop serving yourself at all. Don't look for your interests at all, if possible. Live, you, the choleric man, leave to serve your family and deny your own will, your so powerful will. deny it. Make it serve. Seek the welfare of your family beyond your own. And lastly, a man may not be any of these extremes, but he's inconstant. Resolutions come, they leave out the window. A rule he sets for the children is forgotten the next week. He says to his wife, I will listen from now on. I will get a better job. I will spend more time with you and the kids. Nothing changes. To you, what do I say? Renounce all your little pleasures as much as you can. Video games, gone. Sport, gone. Poker and beers, gone. Have recreation, we can talk about that later. But right now, deny all those things and become accountable to someone that really will keep you accountable. To your friend, to your priest, to your brother. Keep tabs. Ask someone to harass you and make sure that you do what you promised. Whether it be a group, a men's group, a parish, whatever. But Father, leave all my entertainments behind. Isn't that impossible? My friends, I'm almost finished. There's one paragraph left, I promise. Listen, I know, we all know, you will do 50% of what I'm asking you here, if we're lucky, maybe 25. Let me then push you for 100%. So you, the man that is inconstant, do it. Force yourself to do it for a few months. You might come back to some of these things, but having pushed yourself to the extreme of living for your family and renouncing yourself to do it, when you balance things out and maybe you introduce some pleasures back into your life, you will be able to find proper means. Seek the welfare of your family beyond your own. To finish then, a good husband strives for his own perfection, professionally, personally, and spiritually. A good husband loves his wife or someone under his care for God's sake, even if she's imperfect, and he fulfills her needs. And a good husband will seek at all costs the welfare of his family, real and spiritual, beyond his own. We ask our Blessed Mother to aid us to fulfill these resolutions, and we'll take a few minutes for meditation.